irresistible urge to wash your potato. Have you looked out at the world and really trying to figure out what the hell is really going on out there? Well, you come to the right place. Why don't you join Tom and Ramon as we continue our perpetual search. Well, I won't call it perpetual, but our search for the 100th monkey on the 100th Monkey Radio.
Yay!
So who is this we're listening to, Ramon? These guys are awesome.
We're listening to Blaze featuring Garadu. It's called Take a Stand for Love. It's the Shelter Mix. It's one of those old songs from that. I forgot what year it came out, but in the 90s. And I was going out to the New York house clubs all the time.
So you know the guys, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I got to meet the guys from these. Some other things we want to get into before we introduce our guests would be the subscription. If you haven't become a member yet, please become a member. You can listen to Hour 2. This show is not commercial free, so,
yeah,
you know, help us out.
Good stuff. Good stuff. Yeah, we really got quite a lineup coming up, too. We're going to be getting, let's see, we've got a Mary Magdalena coming up next. Isn't that correct, Ramon? I think so, yeah.
No.
Hang on.
No, that's Amari, I'm trying to remember her name.
Oh, John Riley's up next. John Riley.
Yeah, John Riley.
Then Amari Magdalena. And yes. Then George Kavassalis. I do believe we're going to schedule him in for the first week in November.
George Kavassalis will be back. And also we'll have a special guest. We'll call him ZP for now. And he won't be on BBS, but we'll have him up in archive.
Definitely one. If you guys really like the Ralph Ring interview, you're going to want to listen to this guy. He's bringing up some pretty amazing stuff. So
yeah, that should be probably Wednesday or Tuesday, so that one you don't have to wait a whole week for.
Yeah.
Also, the Damn and Her trip. If you're thinking about going, sign up. I should have set up for the payments and stuff for the trip. The airplane tickets you'll have to get yourself. Once we're there, we have to pay 550 euros, and that's for the classes. We'll spend 7 days there. Go over to our Damn and Her link and check out the temple. Why? If you can make it to go, you definitely should go. And that's going to be the 27th of May to the 4th of June, 2012.
Yeah, that's going to be a good trip.
Yes, we get to go to Italy.
Yay. Yay.
So, Ramon, who do we got tonight?
We have Dr. Robert Foreman. Is the author of just released, well, not yet released, soon to be released, Enlightenment Ain't What It Cracked Up to Be. A journey of discovery, snow, and jazz in the soul. He is uniquely qualified both personally and professionally to reimagine the spiritual life. A meditator of 40 years, not that long, he gained a PhD from Columbia University specializing in religions experience around the world and became a tenured professor of comparative religions at the City University of New York. After he retired from teaching, he helped found the Journal of Consciousness Studies and found still direct the Forge Institute of Spirituality and Social Change, which has developed the Soul Jazz family of programs to help people weave the depth of their spiritual discoveries into their everyday lives. Now, before we introduce, I gotta say, this book, which is not out yet, soon to be out.
Well, I think it'll be out by the time you air. Is that correct? This isn't going out tomorrow.
Well, no, this airs what the...
It airs out the 16th.
So the book is out.
Okay, so the book is out.
Newly released. Newly released.
But I'm sorry to interrupt.
Before we really get rolling here, where can they find this newly released book too? Let's get that out there on the table so maybe some people can poke around during it.
Let's introduce them then. Welcome to the show, Dr. Robert Foreman.
Oh.
As you see, you'll see how professional we are.
If you were about to say something nice about the book, so go say it. I want to hear.
Oh, no, I lost train of thought.
When I grabbed this thing, I was a little bit, like Ramon mentioned off the air here, I was a little bit skeptical about the title. You know, Enlightenment ain't what it's cracked up to be. But once I started reading the first chapter just grabbed me and said, wow, this guy is actually really breaking down and explaining the unfoldment process. And I was just amazed at just reading the first chapter, I was hooked. So, yeah, good stuff.
Well, thank you, Tom. And it's really a pleasure to be with you two. We were talking a little bit off the air, and I must say that the kind of work that you're doing of trying to engage people at some depth is extremely valuable, because there's too much hype in the world and there's too much soundbite communication. And I think the idea of attempting to bring intelligent people together to explore the next steps for humanity is a very inspiring task that you've put out for yourselves. And I'm honored to be here with you.
Oh, well, it's our honor by far.
It's our pleasure, and we'll send you a check for saying that. Thank you. So.
Fine, I don't come cheap.
So, one of the things that I found amazing is how you can really find a piece of yourself in this book with the things you personally go through and the self-discoveries that you have. So let's start from the beginning.
Well, the first question, I'd like to start this, Ramon, if you don't mind.
Sure, go ahead.
What happened in your life? Was there something in your life that happened that made you decide that you wanted to start exploring consciousness, exploring meditation and this enlightenment process?
What a great way to start. When I was in college, I became severely depressed. I was probably chronically depressed, suicidal. Maybe I had some sort of psychotic episodes. I don't know. And I was so messed up. And I tried anything I could think of to see what I could do to help heal this. I knew other people that were also equally depressed, and there was something about me that I'm grateful for. I don't know why it was, but I never quite gave up. I always was looking for what would help. And so I studied philosophy under the foolish thought that that might help. I studied a little psychology. I went to a psychotherapist in college for a little less than a year. I tried yoga. I tried Zen. I tried whatever I could think of that might help with this deep struggle I was having. And then I tried, you know, the next thing I tried was transcendental meditation. And the very first meditation for me took off like a shot. I mean, it was just stunning. And I was not hooked at that point, but I was certainly intrigued. And so I kept meditating, and I started going to these, we call them residence courses, but little retreats that we would take. And lo and behold, I started to have just the first inklings of what I would now call mystical experiences. And they were really, it was a sort of momentary sense of being part of a vast silence. And that silence was very appealing, very rich. And little by little, I became hooked. And ultimately, I spent, after about 2 years of meditating, I went off for a 9-month meditation retreat. That was 6 to 8 hours a day of meditation for 9 months. And in retrospect, I just feel extremely grateful I could do that. It was such a remarkable year. And that was really where the first experiences came, and it was where I discovered the possibility of all this. And it was also where I was surprised and disappointed with the experiences. So, yeah, I would say it was really the depression and the psychological messed upness that was the beginning of my life of exploration of the inward side of life.
So you said you really started experiencing something in those meditations. What was the experience? What really first grabbed you and brought that intrigueness? We're making new words now. I like that.
Yes, the intrigueness game. Well, my very first mystical experience probably happened about 6 months after I'd started meditation, and I was walking through Central Square, which is in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and all of a sudden Central Square seemed like it was kind of sort of quiet, and I looked around and buses were going down the street. People were walking and horns were blaring, but there was something about Cambridge that seemed very quiet. And then I began to realize that it wasn't in Cambridge, it was in me, that there was this sort of sense of quiet, the sense of, I'd now use the word silence, but I didn't have the word at the time. And there was a sense of being part of this, it was almost cloud-like, like being part of this sense of something stretching out around me. And it was as if Central Square had this sort of cush of a cloud floating down and making everything very quiet. And I'd say the experience probably lasted for maybe a minute, 2 minutes. I had the feeling in the middle of all this, I had the feeling that so-and-so was going to walk up and I was going to see her walking over that hill over there. And lo and behold, within about 30 seconds, she walked up and there she was coming over the hill. So it was, you have an experience like that, you go, that's interesting.
Whoa. And,
yeah. So, yeah, it was that kind of thing.
If you don't mind, I would actually like to dive a little bit into the quote-unquote dark parts of your life, because there might be some people right now who are going through the same thing or coming out of the same thing, or we have a friend or family member going through the same thing. For somebody who is attempting suicide, what would be your advice now with the experience you have to kind of help them get out of that? Or is there anything you can actually say to a person?
I from the book that there were times I was suicidal. I was probably 20 at the time. There was one time I was poised over a bridge ready to jump off, and I don't know what made me not jump, honestly. And I don't think I have easy advice for somebody that's feeling that same way. I know I don't have easy advice. But I can say that in retrospect, what you feel when you're depressed is that depression has always been there, and that it will never end. You can't remember not being depressed when you're depressed, and you can't imagine not being depressed in the future when you're depressed. And I think the only thing to say to somebody is remember that you haven't always felt this way, and remember that you may not feel this way. That would be the only thing I would know to say. I mean, obviously, these are very personal matters, and it's always a question of, what's behind this. I can say, and this is not what you're asking, but I'm going to say it anyway. I can say that at this point, I consider depression my best friend. And it's not to say I'm depressed. I'm definitely not depressed. But I consider that period of time when I was depressed enormously helpful to me. And the reason was that I had been a certain kind of person when I was a kid, a very sunny and happy-go-lucky, and it was false. And I didn't know it was false until I came out of it. Then I began to realize, I'm not that person. And I think the depression came because I came out of a certain way to be, but I didn't know what the new way to be yet was. And so you're sort of left in this dark hole of not quite knowing who you are now and where you are. And coming through that hole is, I think, an enormous boon to humanity. I think that I'm a far better person because I went through that, and I'm a far more authentic person because I was able to go through that hole and come out the other side. When I hear about people giving drugs to people that are depressed, I understand that, you know, sometimes it gets really desperate, but I think that in a certain sense, giving drugs to somebody to try to pacify it or to pablum over it, I think is people lose something of the humanity in the moment. But I do understand why people would do that. It's very debilitating and very difficult.
I notice from my own experience, I had a few friends that were bipolar and really suffered really hard depressions. And what I've noticed is that when they take the drugs, they actually become worse.
Yeah, in a certain sense, they become less themselves, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, a friend of mine's, she would completely, personality is gone. You know, the sweet person that you knew was completely gone.
Yeah, and I think that's a loss. These drugs, you know, it's like they're really a great boon to humanity, but they have a dark side to them, and I agree that there is something dangerous. But let's not get stuck in depression here.
I stuck there. I just wanted to, because so many people suffer from that. So anyway,
One real quick comment. You know, as far as depression and any challenges that we come across in our lives, I have actually turned that all around, and I really promote this to anybody and everybody that's going through issues that happened across my path that bring it up to me that I'm talking with, is that within every black cloud, there's a silver lining. So there's always something to be gained out of every experience that we're going through. And if we're going through a state of depression or, you know, hard crises in the family, personal crises of the soul, there's something to be gained out of it, some knowledge that needs to be, or wisdom that can be gleaned from it. So, you know, that.
Yeah, I would say, and I completely agree, Tom. And for me, the wisdom to be gained was that I think it's more important to be authentically who you are as opposed to inauthentically chipper or inauthentically pretending. So I think for me, and I think for – this is not just my thought, but I think for a lot of people, depression can be a sign of movement out of something inauthentic and a sign of moving into something more real. And that's certainly the way I hold it. When I counsel people, and I do sometimes as a spiritual counselor, I encourage people to not run from depression but to sit with it, and to, as difficult as it is, to be with it. And to learn what we can with it, as opposed to a given.
Well said. Well said.
Very well said.
Well, thank you. That'll be $10.
God, you have to send the bill. You
check it in the mail.
I'm bad.
Check it in the mail.
So, I want to let's dive into the unzipping part that you experienced during your 9 months, the unzipping of the back of your neck in the beginning, and the beginning of your silence.
Yeah. What would you like to know about it? You want me to just tell the story?
First of all, everybody's going, what? What's he talking about? So you went to a was it an ashram? Or,
in effect, it was an ashram. We were in hotels, but in effect, it was an ashram.
Okay. Well, you went to actually explore spirituality and learn from a master.
Yes.
And this unzipping process was something that you experienced there. Would you enlighten us on that?
Let me talk, if you don't mind, about what I understand the nature of enlightenment to be, and then I'll come back to this.
Oh, great.
Okay?
Okay.
I think enlightenment, it's one of these terms that's really bandied about. You know, a lot of people will say you had an idea, a good idea, you were enlightened, etc. I think enlightenment means something very specific. I mean, and I can say this both as an individual that's been struggling with this his whole life, but also as a scholar of this material. And I think what happens is that there's a kind of a shift in the mind or in the way one is. And I think it can be most clearly understood from a Hindu text from the 6th century BC called the Manduka Upanishad. And it goes like this. Two birds, inseparable companions, perch on the same tree. One eats the fruit, the other looks on. The first bird, it says, is our individual self, feeding on the pleasures and pains of this world. The other bird is the universal self, silently witnessing all. And I think what happens in the process of gaining enlightenment, and I can say that I'm describing something that's not just a Hindu term, but I see it in Buddhism and Christianity and Judaism and Islam. I think what happens is that there's this sense of a kind of an inward silence, an inward openness, an inward sense of freedom that it comes to be established, as it were, behind everything that we think or see or know. And that sense of silence, the Upanishads call the universal self. That's a pretty highfalutin term, and I'm not quite sure I know what it means, but I can say that the sense of silence has no particular language to it. It has no particular images to it. It's simply a sense of being present. And so what happens when someone gains enlightenment is that you discover this sense of open presence or open consciousness. And that becomes, as it were, the observer, or as Upanishads puts it, the witness of everything that we do. So that the shift goes from I'm just doing my activity to I'm doing my activity now held in the in the vision of or in the bosom of consciousness. And that sense of being held is very different than it was. And that's the kind of thing that happened to me. And the story that you're referring to, Ramon, is that this sense of this open consciousness didn't come in one fell swoop for me. It came in a series of, I call them little tubes. So one tube on the left side of the back of my head just sort of went, and then it was silent in there. And then the next tube in the back of my head, this is 2-3 days later, went, and then it was silent. And then, this took weeks, several weeks, 2, 3, 4 weeks, as this thing was moving over. And it was, the weird thing was nothing else was changing. It was like this very weird sense of silence in the back of my neck on the left side and on the right side, you know, just regular thoughts and whatnot. And then the last one shifted over and something really did change. And then I would say that this description from the Upanishads is actually pretty accurate, that you have a sense of you do your activity, you do what you do. But behind it, or as it were, observing it, is this sense of open, free, effort consciousness held effortlessly. So that, I mean, one of the things that surprised me, and this is why I wrote the book, frankly, one of the reasons that surprised me was that, that everything we'd heard as young meditators said that life was going to be grand after an experience like this. And I'm not sure if what happened to me was, you know, full-fledged neon light enlightenment, but it was certainly reasonably close. I can say that my life didn't change a whit after this thing. I was still anxious a lot. I was still depressed a lot. I was still screwing up every relationship I had. You know, it was like nothing changed. I just was now witnessing this same depressed, miserable, anxious, silly kid. That was very disconcerting to me, and I did not recognize what had happened to me as enlightenment at all, because I thought, well, enlightenment is this wonderful state, and I'm the same schnook, you know, I'm the same.
So it's not, as you describe in the book, it's not a character transplant.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah. I honestly thought that it was, but as I say in the book, Enlightenment ain't what it's cracked up to be. Enlightenment wasn't what it was cracked up to be. It was not a personality transplant. It was not the end of the. It was not the end of anything. It was. It was more like, what's that? You know, and it's like, what is this? And that became the question that frankly dominated my life for the next 30, 40 years, trying to figure this out.
So you didn't begin flying and walking through walls or anything like that?
Well, I walked into quite a few walls, but it was only when I was drunk, actually. No, I didn't get drunk that much, I swear. No, I did not fly. I did not gain any supernormal powers. I did not gain the ability to, you know, to see through walls. Unfortunately, it'd be neat to see through walls, wouldn't it?
Sometimes.
And frankly, I'm not, you know, as I've read about this stuff, I've come to agree with the Zen Buddhists. They call such the quest for supernormal powers is the quest for what they call makyo. And there's a certain kind of, it means both a kind of illusion, but it also means a kind of questing for power. And that's right. Not what this stuff is about.
Right. Now, I do see people who, through their process of enlightenment, quote unquote, their growth process, when they start tapping into these the inner peace and et cetera, all the different things that come along with exploring your own personal consciousness and going within, that sometimes people do have things that are added to them, and what I have noticed is that these gifts that seem to be added or people access. It's not so much the ones that I see that are really doing good with it. They're not the ones that have gone out and looked for this stuff. This is something that's just been given to them as a tool to do the work that they're already doing. That helps them, helps assist them with the work that they're already doing. So,
I can say, you know, my experience has been that over the years, some powers that some abilities, powers is the wrong word, but some abilities that I didn't used to have, I have. But the idea that becomes sort of the desirable thing is scary to me. I'd rather become a free human being. I'd rather become a fulfilled human being than have any of these abilities. So I think that it's a dangerous sort of quest to be looking for them. But I agree with you. Sometimes people get these abilities, and then if they use them in the course of doing what they do, I think bully for them. I think, frankly, a lot of people have a certain kind of sensitivities that we're not aware of, and we only become aware of sort of as we're going through things. And I would say of this sort of thing, that's the kind of thing that's happened to me and continues to happen to me in interesting ways. But it's certainly not someplace I want to put my attention.
Right.
Yeah. Later on, when you came back and you're trying to figure everything out, I love that part when you're talking to this is like several years later, maybe I'm trying to remember where it was in the book, where you're talking to the monk and he says, this is that.
Oh, that was Ramdas.
Oh, okay.
Wait, you want me to read that little passage?
Sure.
That'd be great.
All right. If you could stop the tape recorder there for a second, it's going to take me a second. All right, it's 72.
Problem.
72.
We'll put after music now. Your call was taking an order that. Oh.
I described to Ram Dass is a man that I got to know personally. I was on a series of weekends with him. We were in a group working on a project together at Fetzer Institute, and he and I would sit in the back of the room and crack jokes. I just loved the man, and I took him aside and I told him the story, roughly the story I've just told you. And I told him about the tubes and the unzipping, and I told him about other experiences. And finally he says, yes, this sounds like what we talk about. This is what? And looking deep into my eyes with his bottomless gaze and a kindly smile of recognition, he said, "Yeah, this is that." One simple sentence. Yeah, this is that. And all my self-doubts, all my wonderings and confusions and disillusionments simply vanished. "Yeah," he said, "this is that." I smiled and I thanked him. And then I locked myself in a nearby bathroom and I wept. I just cried. Finally, I stopped asking the damn question. Was this it or not? I didn't have to wonder if I was imagining things. Finally, I could be sure I wasn't making all this up. Yeah. What a simple act of love that was. Nothing inside changed that day. The silence was still silent. The expanse still expanded. But everything. Now, when I thought about my life or about the silence that had by then grown well beyond my skull, I could now in good conscience compare it to what I was reading or hearing. I could now plausibly use my own experience as a touchstone, and I could stop the endless. Yeah, so it was, I considered what he did for me that day just such an enormous gift. And I talked to him about it afterwards, and he and I both understood that somehow, in the middle of all this, you go through these experiences and you really at some point want the confirmation that you're not crazy, that you're not making this up, that this really is what they're talking about or what you've been talking about. And it was a huge gift, and it was an act of love. And I've had the good fortune of doing the same thing for several other people. And I must say it feels like love from the other end too. So, yeah.
That's actually quite amazing. One of the amazing things I find is when you go through experience, it's such a comfort when you can meet somebody else that can say, "Yeah, I went through that as well." But what I find a lot that happens, at least into the part when I started becoming more active and going to certain places, that I had no one to talk to. I had nobody to say, you know, I went through this experience, and if I tried it, it was like, nah, it's just a dream, or you know, whatever. You're just going crazy.
Yeah. Well, somehow we want. I can take that one step further, Ramon. Let me take a second to explore something else with you. What I say in Enlightenment Ain't What It's Cracked Up to Be is that it is. Important to know what we're talking about when we talk about silence. But the key of silence, or the key fact of the Enlightenment experience as I see it described in the different traditions and of my own experience, is that the silence itself, that new thing that gets established, that witnessing bird, is absolutely without effort. It takes no work at all to experience that or hold it. So it's not like you're sort of working to remember to be silent. Rather, it just is there, like a right hand or like a nose on your face. And I think the challenge that it issues, certainly the challenge that it issues to me, is can you live your life with that same level of effortlessness and openness and freedom? Can you bring the ease and freedom that you find in the deepest times of silence into your everyday life? And I think the most important piece of doing that, and this is something I feel quite sure about at this point, I think the most important thing about being without effort in your own life is to be willing to tell the real truth in virtually any situation. Doesn't mean you have to tell the real truth to everybody around you, but you have to know what the real truth is in yourself. And I think what I hear you pointing to, Ramon, is that when you drop to a certain level of truth-telling, when you are able to say, here I am in all my vulnerability and all of my fear and all of my strength, when you can drop to that level of vulnerability, it is such a joy to be able to do that with somebody that you can do that with. And if you can't find people that can do that, you still are able to do it, but you feel much more alone. And I think the challenge of the spiritual seeker is to be able to live their life at the same level that they discover at the depths of their time on the meditation mat. And that's, I think, what you're pointing to. And that's something I really want to explore with you guys as we continue this conversation.
All right. So people talk about having one foot in this world and one in the other.
Yeah.
And when you do get your foot in that other world, it definitely being able to continue to navigate through the third dimensional world, the things that we have to do every day, the paying the bills, the going to work, all those different things, holding those things. Two things together, and being able to continue to exist here with some sense of sanity, I guess.
I'd like to read you a little passage from Enlightenment Aim, What Is Cracked Up to Be. May I do that?
Sure.
As you talk about living your life in both worlds, that's something that I've really been struggling with. And because, in effect, what you're looking for is how to live a life of integrity, even in the context of, deep meditative experiences and deep spiritual experiences. And I say on page 9 of Enlightenment, Aim, What Is Cracked Up to Be, enlightenment turned out to be far more ambiguous than the single summum bonum, single supreme good for which I and so many others have been longing. So here I sit, even as I talk to you guys, in just that ambiguity, steeped permanently in some approximation of the openness to which enlightenment points, yet at the same time anxious about the loneliness and whether I'll have anything worthwhile to say. Whatever this strange both and life is, it is far more ambiguous than any all or none, or indeed anything I could ever have imagined before all this started. I am way too much beast to be a god man, and far too much god to be beast.
Very well put.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So,
yeah.
One of the things that I've noticed is people who really get into the meditation thing, I've seen that they tend to suffer from is, for example, they move out into the country or they move it up into a cave, and then and then as soon as they can't do the city life anymore. Yeah. It's I have a few friends in California that they just can't come back to New York City. It's just they're too sensitive to the energy and they can't handle it anymore.
I think what you're pointing to is a very deep problem for folks on the spiritual path. And it's that we have to move out of the city and go off to live in the country and whatnot, but it's also that we distance ourselves from each other. It's like, I'm working on my spiritual life. And as a result, you don't interact with people in a very real and vulnerable making way. I found that I was doing this to my own wife, frankly, and this is one of the lessons of my life, that I was using my spiritual life as a way to keep her at bay, at a distance. And I used it like, I don't need to deal with her problems. I don't need to deal with her nagging. I'm just going to go off and sit in my Buddha belly. And it's an easy out. And I think it's a danger of the spiritual life, that we all can kind of remove ourselves from the everydayness of life and remove ourselves from the satisfactions of life by pulling our way into our Buddha places. So I think what you're pointing to is a real danger, man. I think it's really a problem for spiritual. Yeah.
There's an awful lot to be said about the third dimension. I mean, there's a lot here that we're here for a reason. I mean, we're here to learn. We're here to grow. And if you pull yourself out of that environment, if you go take yourself out of the classroom, then you're definitely not going to be learning anything.
Right. And I also think that really what we're after, and here's part of the reason why I wrote Enlightenment Aim, What Is Cracked Up to Be. I think part of the mistake I was making was that I thought once you gain enlightenment, everything will be fine. And then the lesson of my life has been, Yeah, getting enlightenment is good and all, but and it's wonderful to have silence and all. But really, what I'm after is not this inner silence. I'm after a fulfilling life. I want to have a complete whole life. I want to live everything in my life, and I want to have it be all rich and full and free and alive. That's, I think, what we should be after, whether people are after that. I think that's really what this is, you know, what you're describing the classroom is about. You know, it's the classroom is about, okay, are you blocked up here in your relationships? All right, there's your classroom, dealing with your wife. Are you blocked up over there in your work life? Okay, there's your classroom, right in your work cubicle or in the line in the machine shop. You know, are you messed up in the way that you deal with money? Okay, let's deal with money in a straight up, open, free, alive, healthy way. You know, so it's, I think that the classroom is designed to get us to be open and free and alive and connected in everything we do. And so I want to be able to play rock and roll, and I want to be able to meditate, and I want to be able to dance my brains out, and I want to be able to be completely honest with you, and I want to be able to be real in all of it. And that's, I think, the challenge for us. So that's, the classroom leads to that, Tom, I think.
Taking off the masks in all your different places.
In all the places, right. And any places that you've still got the damn mask on, how can we get it off? Yeah. Which has to do, I think, with truth telling.
Which takes me up to another part. One of the things I see a lot, and I actually was experiencing, and then I kind of stopped doing that, was, for example, when someone offends you, someone bumps you on the train or something like that, and it makes you upset, that because you're on this path, you let it go. But what I see a lot of people do is really they're bottling it in a different way, and they smile and they say, you know, be on your journey, or they say something nice to the person instead of getting upset. But then it comes to a time where they blow up.
God, don't we all know this?
And the most peaceful person that you knew just became...
That's right. Jack the Ripper.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think that points to something, and here I've got a little plug to make. I think what you're pointing to is that it is possible to be not just covering over things that are difficult, but you dig into them and you tease them out and you start telling the truth about what really bothers you. It doesn't mean you have to tell it to other people, by the way. It does mean you have to tell it to yourself. Being able to tell the truth about where you are, about your pains, about what hurts, about who you haven't been, about what you've been doing, that, I think, is a key act. And some colleagues of mine and I have developed a program. It's called Soul Jazz. And it's designed to help people move into their own depths in the everyday. And it's designed to help people find what is really true for them and move it forward. So that the Soul Jazz program offers folks, it's a series of workshops. One could take the first workshop, and it helps people experience being deeply nourished and what it is to be, and being deeply nourished by dropping into soulfulness. And it also helps develop the understanding and the skills to do this intentionally, so that we can do it out in the real world every day, all the time, if we want. And then it also offers an ongoing community of support and practice that helps folks keep this going. And I've seen it do wonders for folks, and it certainly has helped me a lot. And I'm almost done with the plug, and you can find it by means of a website called godeepertogether.org. That's godeepertogether.org. Okay, now I'm done with the plug. Thank you very much. And back to our regularly scheduled program.
Well, let's dive into that, because I find that's very important. What are, for lack of words, what are some of the social benefits of this? Because this is, as you describe in the book, it's such a lonely journey at times. So to be able to do that as a group and fall into that, it's a whole different story.
I liked your story about the $27,000. I don't know how appropriate this is for this part of the conversation, but that just popped into my head for some reason.
Good. That brings up the whole question of ethics. Let me talk to Ramon first, his question, then let's go over to the question of ethics, because I think both are important here. How are we doing on time, guys? Do we have 10, 15 minutes left?
Oh, we're doing good.
We got 15 minutes on the first hour.
Great. Okay. I think, Ramon, the lesson that I've learned, and the Soul Jazz program has been enormously helpful at this, but the lesson that I've learned is that if you can drop into what is really so for you, that is to say, if you can discover or even work to discover what is really true for you, if you can be on that path of kind of teasing out, often the teasing out process sounds like this. Often it sounds like, I don't know quite what I'm feeling here, but I know it's not blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I'm feeling a little excited, but I don't quite know what it is. So that at that moment may be what the real truth is. And when I'm engaged with other people, when I'm looking for what is the real truth, when I'm willing to be vulnerable and truth-telling with myself out loud, if I can do that with another person, it's like magic. It is not only reassuring that you're not alone in this, but there's a kind of mutual discovery that starts to take place that I find is just the best thing I know. Honest to goodness, it's the best thing I know, just to be able to do this with other human beings. And what it takes, and I think what I would like to invite your listeners to do, and you know, all of us, what it takes is the willingness to not know together, the willingness to discover, the willingness to wonder out loud together, the willingness to be creative, the willingness to say what's new. And to say what's new is not, hey, what's new? But rather it's like, I've never had this thought before, but you know what I'm thinking here? Or you know what I feel here? And I think that that is so richly human. It is such a gift to be able to share that with another human being. I honestly don't know a better teacher than peers who are willing to tell the truth together. So I completely agree. And the loneliness of the path, Ramon, is a real problem, folks. And it's certainly been a real problem for me. But and this doesn't stop the existential fact that we are each alone, but it certainly is an aid on the path. It certainly is reassuring that we're sharing the path together. Having a hand to hold in the face of the tsunami that is life is just an enormous gift and one of the true privileges of being human. And to some extent, talking to you guys is very much that. It's like just exploring this stuff and being able to talk out loud about what you really think is going on. I think there's something that's a real gift to each of us as we kind of sit with these questions and sit together and not know answers and continue to discover. I think if there's a new paradigm that's dawning, it's the paradigm of being willing to stand in the ambiguity of not knowing and to stand there together holding each other's hand and to be willing to be speaking what is true together. So yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah, we definitely do. Our culture definitely wants to know the results before any question is asked, don't we?
Right. And I think that very needing to have answers quick and cold, I think, is part of the struggle that our culture seems to be facing. So you want to talk about ethics, or should we keep going on that?
Well, let's keep going with this. We'll get into the ethics section in the second hour here.
Okay. So I think there's a real – I think we can do an enormous amount for one another. Again, you know, we started talking in the book, Enlightenment Ain't What It's Cracked Up To Be, talks about the nature of enlightenment. But what the book moves into, and I think what the more important question is, not so much how do we gain spiritual enlightenment, but how do we gain living fulfillment? And this ability to speak truly is so – life becomes so effortless when you're willing to speak what is true. And that's, I think, the gift that I've stumbled across in the course of my lifetime. And I think that's the gift that I want to be able to share with people, that it's speaking the truth and doing it out loud and being willing to not know answers when you don't know them. I think that's really what this is all about. And so the search for enlightenment, I think, was a kind of red herring for me, that what life is really, what the lesson is really about is, can you go to a place of truth-telling with other human beings?
Yeah.
And can you do it in a way that's real and honest and authentic?
I would like to address a little bit the anger part of that. So for so many people, including myself, instead of...
Are you going to yell at me now?
Yes. give me 5 minutes. no, the part where so many people would, like I was saying before, would bottle something up, and then they tell their truth, but when it comes out in such a rush of anger.
Good for you, yeah.
Or for example, the other person reminds you of the experience that you had a long time ago that you've been bottling that up, so you blow up on that person, or even on the stranger on the street.
Right.
What is some of the things to work out on that part?
Because
you're telling the truth.
Yeah.
But the other person is not going to hear you. So now you get people telling each other the truth and nobody's listening.
To not stop. That is to say, you know, I'm going to give an example of yelling at my wife, which unfortunately, you know, she would say happens much too much. I think it doesn't happen enough. But in the past, well, we're doing quite well these days, but in the past, I would say I would yell at her. And she would make me so mad, certain kinds of things she would do. She's very much more orderly than me, et cetera. And I would get really pissed off at her. And I'd yell, and she couldn't hear it, and I couldn't hear it. I think the one thing that we had, and the one thing I would say to your contacts that do like this, is that yelling, that letting out the air, or that letting out the heat, is almost inevitable. We all have to do it sometimes if we've got stuff bottled up. The trick is not to stop. That is to say, you yell, you say, you're being an asshole, you know, you just do that, and then you say, you know, you wait for a few minutes, and you say, you know, I think what's really making me mad is, or, you know what I think I'm really doing here? I think I'm really not upset with you, but with me. Or, you know what's really going on here? I think I've been hurt by so-and-so or by you, and I haven't been able to say it, and I need to recognize that, you know, so that it's most people say, oh, if you get angry, that's a terrible thing. I think, no, anger is part of the story. But if you stop at anger, then you're just laying your gook on somebody else. That's not fun. But if you start with your anger and you let out your anger and then you keep going to look what's under that and look what's under that and look what's under that, now you've got progress. Now you can really move something along. I think that's where things can go. So I'm of the sort that says don't resist your anger, but don't let your anger be the last story. Let your truth be the last story.
We have anger for a reason.
And yeah.
We do have anger for a reason. And that's a very good description of why we have the anger. I mean, it's a tool for us to actually, at least in this, where we're at right now in our growth process, it's one of those emotional tools that we're gifted with to bring us to a point where we get to that place where we're true, we're honest, we're especially true to ourselves.
And I think what Ramon is pointing to is that it's possible to get caught up in the anger so that the other person can't hear you. And I think we all know what that's like. We've all done that. We've all been on both sides of that equation. But if you can use the anger as you're describing, Tom, if you can use the anger as a kind of leaping off point as opposed to an ending point,
right?
I think right then the anger becomes a tool we have in our toolbox, and it's a tool that indicates something's not right here. And then you move it forward. You move it forward as best you can. And I think one of the dangers of the spiritual movement, those of your listeners that are in it, I think one of the dangers is that we all try to, you know, we try to be so nice, and we try to be, hey, man, life is this, you know, life is cool. I think that serves us very poorly in not being able to be full-bodied, emotional, sexual, complicated, ambiguous creatures. I think that's what we should be after, that, not after a sort of placid joy, joy, joy. Oh, yes, life is grand. That's not what I think we should be after. I think we should be after full-bodied humanity.
Yeah, for applying that tool, one thing that I suggest to people is that when something like that arises in their life, that they pull themselves out and try to look at it, at what transpired from a third person's perspective, and look at it objectively, and that within that you'll be able to actually puzzle out the root cause of whatever the issue happens to be.
Yeah. Well, I think if you look at it as a third person, you'll never get there. But if you look at it as a first person and you say, what am I angry about? No, really, what's beneath that? Then I think you can get to it. If you look at, like, you know, well, of course he's angry or I'm angry, as if, you know, as if it's all logical, I think you miss the sort of juice of it.
Yeah. Well, we're getting at the top of the hour, and I want to give you a chance to tell us where we can get your book, since it's out already.
Yes, right. Yes, the book is called Enlightenment Ain't What It's Cracked Up to Be, A Journey of Discovery, Snow, and Jazz in the Soul. And you can get it through through the book's website, enlightenmentain't.com. Or if you want, just go to amazon.com, and it's certainly available there. And I think many local bookstores are carrying it. Again, the book is called Enlightenment Ain't What It's Cracked Up to Be. All right. And the Soul Jazz program, if I could mention that, again, the website on the Soul Jazz program, if you want to hear about what's going to be happening with that, it'll start up in February. The URL for that is godeepertogether.com. And so thank you for giving me that, the ability to say that.
Okay, well,
that'll be $14.95.
Yeah. What are we up to now, anyway? Jeez.
I don't know. We've been giving money back and forth.
I think we're even now.
Okay, well, I want to thank everybody for listening to the first hour here on BBS, and stay tuned for Brooks Agnew coming up right after us, and then pop on over to the website and listen to our second hour with Dr. Robert Foreman.
Yay!
So
thank you very much, and it's been wonderful to talk this hour with you guys.
Condemnation without investigation is the height of ignorance, and we love you guys.